Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program was brought to you by Roth Wisconsin, makers of the world's best cheese and pioneers in the U.S. artisan cheese movement. For more information, visit rothcheese.com.
I'm Laura Stanley, host of Inside School Food. You are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
I'm sure you remember the first time, probably as a child, that someone cracked open a coconut for you, or maybe poked a hole in it or a couple of holes so you could stick in a straw and drink that sweet water. Did you ever think about their background and where they came from? We're going to find out all about coconuts today on A Taste of the Past. Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palaccio, on this weekly journey through culinary history. And indeed, the coconut has enthralled people, particularly young people, for centuries, forever. And as I said, you can probably remember the first time you witnessed the coconut or even tried yourself to crack one open. Of course, if you have traveled to the Caribbean islands or even actually throughout Europe, then you knew that coconuts were pretty much in evidence all the time around. And now in America, they're part of the staple on the grocery shelves. But it wasn't always so. And today, my guest is Ramin Ganeshram, and Ramin is a journalist and professional chef trained at the Institute of Culinary Education in New York City. For many years, she was an award-winning writer for the New York Times and Newsday. She's the author of several cookbooks, including Sweet Hands, Island Cooking from Trinidad and Tobago, and the IACP Award winner in her most recent, Cooking with Coconut. Her writing has been featured in Saveur Gourmet, when it was around, Bon Appetit, and Epicurious, as well as National Geographic, and so many others. Welcome, Ramin.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
I actually happened upon an article that you had written about, I'm going to say the coconut diaspora, in a sense. But, you know, the coconuts being dispersed throughout all the different islands. But give us a little background from what we know. I mean, I know a lot is still in debate, and some much of it is folklore as well. But where are the coconuts? Where do they originate?
Well, it's interesting. The National Geographic Society actually undertook a study that was completed in 2011 that pretty much definitively says that coconuts came from India and Southeast Asia. And in fact, all of the world's coconuts are, you know, they sort of can be traced back to those genomes of these original coconuts in India and Southeast Asia. And, of course, it's spread around the world. The debate lies in exactly when and how, but the methods are pretty clear. We do know all the different ways coconuts have gotten to the Caribbean, for example, and, you know, into Africa, for example.
Well, in so many, and I say a lot of it was folklore too, because people said, well, coconuts float, and they just floated across the water and landed on the shore. And then Thor Heyerdahl comes along and does a little test that says, no, that's not possible. And brought him on the Contiki with him, sailing across the South Pacific. So, I mean, certainly, as we will hear from you more during the rest of the show, is that the islands, many of these Caribbean islands and South Pacific islands, they were all settled by so many different travelers that they would, I'm sure, load them on their boats, right?
Absolutely. And in fact, you know, coconut traveled almost from its beginning in the boats of traders who were either, for example, Arab traders who, you know, went around the coast of India. Ultimately, they brought it to Africa. They brought it up into the Middle East from North Africa, from where it traveled on the Silk Road to Europe. Mm-hmm. And with respect to the Caribbean, it is the same idea. Those same European colonizers who experienced coconut through the Silk Road, who then their travels to India and Africa brought it very specifically to the Caribbean, looking for not just coconut, but looking for those plants from around the subtropical world that could also grow in the Caribbean. So that's kind of interesting about the Caribbean, that a vast variety of things that we associate as Caribbean, in fact, were brought there from the South Pacific, from Africa, mm-hmm. from India.
Interesting.
And coconut is clearly, chief right. among those.
Well, and along with the coconut came their cuisine, because you had to find a way to use these. I mean, initially, I'm sure people just, you know, wanted to drink the juice and, you know, and chew the sweet, tasty meat of the coconut once they could find a way to get into it, right? But
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was going to say, although, you know, it's interesting that when the Arab traders went into India and into Southeast Asia, where the coconut was native, they had already observed people, this is, 2,000-3,000 years ago, had already observed people figuring out how to not just eat the meat and drink the water, but make a thick, sort of soupy, what we would call coconut milk, out of the meat mixed with water, ground together, and to use the fiber of the coconut plant in a cloth-like way. And in fact, making boats out of coconut planking, the wood of the tree and the fiber from the fruit. So, fairly early on, they figured out that this fruit can be used in so many different ways.
Right, right. Which made it such a popular and interesting fruit to take with them and not terribly perishable if your trip is under 100 days. But, I mean, also, it doesn't bruise. It just sort of, you can just throw it in a bottom of a bag. I mean, this was a pretty good deal for these people. And in
absolutely.
Fact, well, so let's talk about a lot of the money that was made off of it. I mean, coconut palms, they then found their way onto these islands, but then came all the colonists, and they came for a couple of reasons, one of them being the coconut crops. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's true. So initially, particularly in the Caribbean, we really talk about sugar and cocoa being the primary crops that really made fortunes. But there were certainly people who made fortunes on coconut as well, more into the later. So, the cocoa and the sugar fortunes can date back to the 18th century, right? But the coconut fortunes started really in the 19th century because of a greater use of the fruit in the United States. Mm. It was used in the United States in the 18th century. There's no doubt we have evidence of that. But, the South is the area that was always associated with coconut, even when the rest of the country stopped using it. And that really did provide a great market for it. And what's interesting about the coconut, I think, in terms of fortune and in terms of status and wealth, is that because it was considered so rare in Europe, because it was rare in Europe, as early as the 15th century, in the 1400s in Europe, they were making, and there's some really, really good examples of this in the British Museum's online archive, goblets of coconut shells that were mounted on gold stands and encrusted with jewels and decorative objects in which precious metals were wrapped around or incorporated into carvings made from coconut shells. So there was already this predisposition to think about the coconut as something very precious, very rare, very high end. So it was very much a status symbol in the United States, particularly in the South, where it was more likely to land in its whole form without perishing. So coconut's really interesting. It not only made fortunes, but it became a symbol of fortune in many ways.
Huh. So, I mean, it's true. When you crack up, you have this wonderful shell. It feels so wasteful to throw it away. Use it as a bowl. Use it as a cup. I mean, I can see where that was terrific that they gilded it then and put it on a pedestal. That's very interesting.
It is.
Yeah. What we didn't do is talk about the name, and the name is interesting, coconut, where, you know, some people say, well, because it's grown in a lot of places where the cocoa bean is grown, and so it's a cocoa nut, and it's not chocolate, it's not cocoa. But that name, you know where the name comes from, I'm sure, right?
Yeah, it was actually Portuguese traders that named this fruit, cocoa being a form of the word like head or skull, and they thought it looked like a skull because of the eyes, because of those three eyes
dots, at
the top of the plant. Yeah, so it kind of, you know, looked like two eyes and a nose, and it's roughly around the size, you know, the inner nut, not the whole big fruit, roughly the size of a man's head, more or less. And they were the ones that started to call it that, and that became essentially, it became the name.
Yeah.
So because the word was cocoruto, which meant skull.
Huh, interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the grinning, it kind of looks like a funny grinning face, and so coco became sort of like a crazy, meaning like crazy or grinning or, and all that related to the coconut. That's great.
Yeah.
You were talking about people making their fortunes, and of course later on when we had some, when the Industrial Revolution came in and we started to mass produce fruit and vegetables, not in their natural form, but coconut, because coconut is a lot of work grating all that coconut.
Yeah.
And something that Americans know quite well, you go to the grocery store and maybe you're baking, or you go and you look for coconut, the first thing you see on the shelf is not coconut in its natural form or anything, but it's that blue bag, very popular bag. Can you tell us a little bit about that story?
You know, that's actually a great story, and I have it in Cooking with Coconut. And so, you know, to really kind of appreciate this story, we have to back up a little bit, which is that apparently, and I say apparently only because, you know, I've seen it in a couple of sources, and I always like to verify things by multiple sources, but in the South particularly, there was such a thing called the Coconut Man, right? There was a man who sold coconut. And, you know, would open it for you, you know, they came on ships from the Caribbean, would open it for you, grate it, give you the water, whatever it is that you wanted to do with it. It was very much a Southern convention. It was very much a small town convention that pretty much had died out, you know, by probably the 1880s or 90s, from my understanding. But there was a gentleman named Baker, who Franklin Baker, actually senior, who had a wheat mill in Philadelphia, and this is in the 1890s. And Philadelphia had long been a city, as I'm sure you know, of milling, right? Milling grain and sugar from the 18th century, in fact, and. So he was very young. He was an entrepreneur. He had this business, and he decided he was going to expand his business into Cuba. So he did, and he had sent his grain, his flour, to Cuba, and instead of payment, what came back was a hold full of coconut. And he just didn't know what to do with this, and he just thought, you know, what am I going to do with these fresh coconuts? It wasn't easy to unload at that point. You know, Philadelphia wasn't a city like those cities in the South that had a lot of experience with this fruit. There had actually been one small coconut seller in Philadelphia who had sold coconut products, sold coconuts, sold a small amount of dried or grated coconut, and had gone out of business. So he bought the operation and figured out a way to mass grate and dry the coconut so that it could be shelf stable.
No easy task.
No, it's not, because coconut has a lot of fat, right? And
right.
So it becomes rancid once it's out of its shell, fairly quickly, in fact. As anyone who's ever opened a can of coconut milk and not used it all in one go, they realize by the third day in the refrigerator, it's not so good. So basically, he ultimately, very smart marketing, started selling it with recipes for baking, started really promoting it as a baking product. I think his name probably didn't hurt, Franklin Baker. And he started selling this dry coconut product, and he made this fortune. And that's the blue bag that we are all accustomed to, Baker's sweetened coconut flakes. The sugar that he added to the dried coconut actually served as a preservative. So that allowed,
That's great. I mean, it's something that, you know, when you're rummaging through the shelves and you just really need something sweet, sometimes that blue bag is sitting there and it's an instant treat. You know, you can get into it and eat that. But that brings me to the topic of the cuisine and cooking with coconut. And in this country in particular, it is associated for many years with a sweet baked items mostly, and or the Coco Loco, the sweetened coconut cream for a piña colada for those who, you know, were making fancy drinks, and the items that you could find in grocery stores were basically only the sweetened flaked coconut. When do you get, you know, like when, how did we sort of get some of the other cuisines to be more familiar with us and have the products that we can now use for, let's say, curries and mm-hmm. creams and sauces?
Well, you know, I think that what really this has to do with, it's kind of a long, it was a long process based on immigration and acceptance and adaptation to what we would call "quote unquote" ethnic foodways in the United States, starting very specifically with Latino food, mm-hmm. where, you know, first Mexican and then other Latino diasporic foods became popular because, you know, of immigration in the United States. But what that did was open the door to other flavors within those cuisines. So, you know, one tropical fruit kind of led to another tropical fruit. And I would say that, you know, those cuisines are where interest in coconut started to open up. And to your point, still within that realm of the dessert, right? So mm-hmm. maybe it would be a coconut rice pudding. Maybe it would be a coquito, which is a Puerto Rican version of eggnog that uses coconut milk mm-hmm. In it. But then as knowledge of the larger cuisine expanded and then, you know, dishes that incorporated coconut milk or maybe unsweetened coconut flakes started to come in, and they served as a bridge to other cuisines that had the same flavor profiles, heat, right, chilies. So there you add Indian, you add Thai, you add some African cuisines. Rice, same thing, right? And coconut, mm-hmm. which fits really well. And actually, the Culinary Institute of America, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, did a lot of work on this idea of bridge cuisines, how the flavors that appear in one accepted culture become the gateway to other accepted cultures, as long as there are other factors to bring them into the zeitgeist, like immigration, for right. example.
Right. Yeah, bridge cuisines is that's a great term, because it has opened our world in many ways. After we learn about the food, first somebody has to go and travel and say, wow, eat this really good food, and they bring it back and they want to, you know, replicate it. And then suddenly we know the cuisine before we know the country. And,
right.
you know, lo and behold, you know, you go and you learn about the country. We're going to talk about the cuisine of a specific country, after we take a short break, because I think it's so interesting how the coconut is incorporated into the cuisine. We're talking about Trinidad and Tobago, where you have a personal relationship, and a lot of the other Caribbean islands, and how it is their cuisine. However, again, it's one of those cuisines that many of the different dishes that incorporate the coconut come from many other countries. So we're going to talk about that when we come back after a short break. Stay tuned. Mm-hmm.
And this one is called Home by The Hollows. We'll be right back.
I went down to North Carolina.
Have you tasted the world's best cheese? Grand Cru Sauchois is the 2016 World Cheese Champion. Our partners at Roth, Wisconsin make this gorgeous alpine-style cheese in the rolling hills of Greene County, Wisconsin. Grand Cru Sauchois is produced by hand in Swiss copper vats and finished by aging on spruce planks. The quality milk and careful craftsmanship bring out the award-winning light floral notes, nutty undertones, a hint of fruitiness, and a mellow finish. Perfect with Riesling and Muscat, Grand Cru Sauchois is a guaranteed hit for any occasion. Check out their other offerings at rothcheese.com. You'll discover Buttermilk Blue and their newest release, Prairie Sunset, the golden-hued love child of Mimolette and Gouda. You'll also find recipes like the Raclette Reuben and tomato tartlets. Everything you need to know about the world's best cheese is at rothcheese.com.
Hi, we're back, and I'm talking with Ramin Ganeshram, and we're talking about coconuts. We're talking about coconuts, and we're also talking about the cuisine of the countries that incorporate a lot of coconut in their cooking. And with Ramin, we're going to talk about the cuisine of Trinidad and Tobago. Ramin, tell us a little bit about your connection with that location.
Sure. Yeah. So my father was born in Trinidad and Tobago. He was the grandchild of at least, and I say at least because these are the only three people that we can readily identify, which often happens in these types of immigration stories, three East Indian indentured laborers and a fourth grandparent whose identity we don't know, but we're pretty sure was an East Indian. So they came in the 1840s, 1850s to Trinidad as part of the British Empire's essentially program, if you want to call it that, scheme, to bring indentured laborers into Trinidad to replace enslaved workers, which had slavery had ended in the Caribbean around 1832. So that's my connection. My father was born there. He was third generation. And as a result, he would often bring my brother and I back to Trinidad almost every summer. He was a New York City school teacher, to spend the summer there with his family. So we really got to have an immersion, if you will, into the culture, not just from being the child of a Trinidadian immigrant, but getting to go there and live there and be, you know, fully part of society there. And experience it that way.
Well, which is wonderful because you got to know the food. And, of course, I saw many of these, you know, the slave labor for the sugarcane plantations and the cocoa. And then coconuts come right behind that. I mean, we're talking about a country that had so many influences, as many of these smaller islands with the colonists from, you know, the Spanish to the Dutch to the French and then ultimately the British. So all of these influences play large. And, of course, as you mentioned before, the traders who would, you know, make stops in these different countries and these different islands and bring their cuisine or adapt some of their food to, you know, what they had there. And I found that you wrote a book several years ago called Sweet Hands. And it's the cuisine of the cooking of Trinidad and Tobago. And I found it just wonderfully interesting doing, first of all, leafing through and doing, you know, a kind of a broad look at the different recipes. And one page, you go, oh, an Indian, an African recipe, oh, a Chinese recipe. The influences in the cuisine are quite amazing. We have to really stop and think about it, you know, when we start, you know, looking at these foods and cooking these foods, and all wonderful and using a lot of similar ingredients. As a child, you were there, spent a lot of time, loved. You have some wonderful stories where you're talking about your introduction to loving the different fruits and particularly the sweets. We talked about sweets before, but in writing a book about the island cooking, you really had to go and do more of a culinary trip and culinary research, did you not?
Yes. In fact, I went back two or three times for the express purpose of doing culinary research, you know, not to visit family, not to visit friends, but to go as a chef and a food writer into kitchens of people I didn't know, into restaurant kitchens, into estates, which is what we call plantations, and interview people and really understand it from the ground up, not just the narrow viewpoint I had as a Trinidadian American looking into my family. Although I have to say that, you know, most Trinidadians, because especially now three and four generations out from, you know, colonization and being a colony, we're so ethnically mixed in all of our families and our heritages are so intertwined that you do actually have a pretty good broad understanding of all the influences without even realizing that you do, you know. So, but I did then go about taking that base foundational knowledge and do several research trips to kind of understand the history and what actually this means. And it was enlightening because there were some things that I, like many Trinidadians, thought were one thing, but actually were entirely something different.
And anything that ties together these different dishes in the cuisine that you would say is sort of a unifying feature or not?
Actually, there are several unifying features. So the first is heat, chili pepper. I'm sure you know that the hottest peppers in the world are often come from Trinidad. In fact, the currently crowned hottest pepper in the world, the Moringa scorpion, is from Trinidad. Which came both from the West African tradition, our West African traditions, and our East Indian traditions. And so, and that has followed through across the cuisine, even adapted cuisines that themselves may not necessarily have a lot of heat. For example, Syrian. We have a very strong Syrian-Lebanese community of a century or more in Trinidad. Those foods have been adapted to include heat. Things like rice, consistent, you know, West Africa is the rice coast of Africa. Of course, India, you know, prodigiously rice-eating country. That's another, you know, continuation. And coconut, of course, you know, so coconut, what's interesting about coconut is that it was enslaved people from West Africa who brought the knowledge of using these, you know, coconuts that were brought as part of the trade routes into the Caribbean, because it traveled from East Africa many, many centuries before to West Africa. So they brought that knowledge. And then the East Indians, you would think that they too would be well-versed, and they were versed, but not well-versed, because most of the East Indians came from the northern part of India to the Caribbean, not the south, which is more of the coconut-consuming area of India.
Interesting.
So, but they were prepared, but there was some usage there, so they were prepared. There was that parity, that ability to say, we know what this is, and you're using it in this way, certainly we can adapt it for the absence of things like milk. You know, it's a small island. You don't have vast herds of dairy cows.
That's so, right, yeah. So then you substitute the natural product. That's interesting.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had to make note, and I will post a picture of a couple of your books, the Coconut Book and the Sweet Hands, the Cooking of Trinidad, on our website, because the cover of that book, to me, just like, you know, said it all before you even wrote Cooking with Coconut. And it's a set of hands grating a coconut into a bowl. And it is such a laborious task, I have to say, having done it many times, but you get used to it. Of course, I have one of those. Someone gifted me a coconut grater that I can actually squat down and sit on. Well, it's kind of little now, but I mean, I used to be smaller too, I suppose. But it has, you know, that very sharp round blade on, I think in the shape of a rabbit or something, and the sharp blade coming out of the mouth. And I think that was probably Southeast Asian made, and that makes it a little easier. You can twist it, and they have machines, you know, that you can hand machines that you can grind the coconut. But it's just wonderful to see. It's a box grater, and there she is, you know, grating it. So tell me. So I'm thinking, oh, Sweet Hands, of course. But Sweet Hands has another meaning. Tell me about the meaning of Sweet Hands.
Yeah, so the meaning of it, and it's interesting because I debated with myself around this title. In Trinidad, if someone says you have, what they say is you have sweet hands, meaning that you're a good cook, that's what it means. That nothing you can make with your hands would turn sour or bitter or bad. You have sweet hands. Now, of course, you say hand because of the patois and the accent, but the word is really sweet hands. So that's why it's called that. And we debated because with that and the coconut on the cover, we were concerned that people would think it was a baking book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's why it says Island Cooking from Trinidad and Tobago. Right. But that's actually what it means. It's a very high compliment in Trinidad if someone says that you have sweet hands.
Interesting. That's
enormous
great.
Compliment.
I love that. I love it. You know, I mentioned before that we weren't, you know, baker's coconut. We're baking the sweet flaked baking coconut. Baker's baking coconut was about the only thing that we could find for many years on the shelves in grocery stores without going to an ethnic grocer or a gourmet food store. And that now it is, I would say, in every grocery aisle, one can find the cans of coconut milk, not the sweetened cocoa, but the regular coconut milk for use in a lot of coconut-based curries and dishes, as well as now, just recently even, we've had different mills. And it's interesting because you talked about Baker having owned a wheat mill. Bob's Red Mill is one of them, and many others that make the grated unsweetened coconuts, flaked and grated and flour, coconut flour. I mean, all of the different uses of coconut, and now coconut oil is enjoying this great boom in cooking in this country. Have you seen more of an interest in the cuisines of these islands once these, I mean, what was it, the chicken or the egg, obviously, but it's more accessible for cooks to be able to use these products?
Yes, absolutely. And I think because of that availability, I mean, I see coconut milk, private label branded by supermarkets, whatever mm-hmm. your local supermarket is.
Right.
They're what we used to call No Frills, right? But the private label brand of coconut milk and coconut water and coconut oil even. And I think that because it was originally touted so much as a health product, and it really does have some wonderful, healthful characteristics, it opened up this interest from that point first, I think, where people said, oh, this is something I want to incorporate into my diet, and then started to look for the how. And luckily, there's this enormous canon of coconut product using recipes from all the coconut producing countries in the world, that number into the hundreds and the thousands. So I think that it just became very easy to say, okay, well, I want to use this, and here's a way to do it. And then that in turn increased their taste for the cuisines of those countries.
All right. Well, I saw a figure probably on Wikipedia or someplace that said that coconut palms are grown in more than 90 countries in the world, and the major producers being the Philippines, Indonesia, and India. And so you immediately think of those cuisines and coconut, the ingredient being used in many of those dishes. Back to the Trinidad and Tobago cuisine cooking. You mentioned that there were a couple of different ties that unify. One was the hot pepper, heat, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And then go on from there, what would the other be?
Rice.
Oh, that's right. You said rice, yeah.
Yeah.
And sugar. They have, it seems to me, quite an affinity for sweets.
Yes. And that's also, again, tied very much into that, in West Africa, in India already, sugar consuming, sugar growing and sugar consuming countries. And then, of course, the sugar being where much of the wealth of the Caribbean originally came from. And so, therefore, something like coconut works really well because it has its own natural mild sweetness. And it's a great substitute for flour in many ways. It's a great substitute for milk in many ways. And so it was kind of a natural marriage to put the two things together. And not just in Trinidad, but throughout the Caribbean. And you're right, the sweet tooth in the Caribbean is legendary. To the point where many of the recipes in Sweet Hands, I cut the sugar, in some cases in half, because it would just be, I think, overwhelming for an American palate. And we're known as Americans for liking sugar, too, but not like a Caribbean person, believe me. So, yeah.
You do a very nice job in talking about a lot of the different ingredients in both of your books on this cuisine. But one that really caught my eye, again, we're talking about two of them, actually, one savory and one sweet. And that is something that that is called mixed essence.
Mm-hmm.
And tell us about mixed essence.
It's interesting you're asking me this, because I just was having a conversation with somebody yesterday about mixed essence. And the fact is, mixed essence is really what it actually is now, is a combination of extracts that have been brought together: almonds, pear, vanilla, for the specific purpose, into one bottle, and it's sold as mixed essence. For the specific purpose, actually, of mimicking a flavoring that comes from tonka bean, which grows in Trinidad. It's a hardwood, the tonka tree. The bean is a large, about an almond-sized bean that has this very distinctive, almost but not quite vanilla flavor. And in fact, we're all familiar with it in vanilla candles or vanilla scented items. That's actually made with a tonka bean. It's not for sale or approved for use in the United States because it is the natural source of coumarin, the blood thinner upon which Coumadin is based, the prescription drug.
Mm-hmm.
So because of that risk of over-ingestion, it's not available for sale in the United States. It is in Europe. Of course, it is in Trinidad. But mixed essence is meant to mimic the flavor and the aroma of the tonka bean, which is a very common flavoring in all baked goods and sweets in Trinidad.
Well, it was on the top of my mind because I made your coconut bread from which book? The one of the books. And it was delicious. The recipe was wonderful. And I am a fool for coconut, especially any sweet coconuts and curries and anything that has coconut. I love coconut. But I made, so I had to make my own mixed essence for it. And it's wonderful. And it turned out you did got that. It was an aroma of regular, when you're baking, almond extract, vanilla extract. But it just, the rum and the orange flower water just brought, pear extract I did not have. So that was missing. But everything else was in there, and it just did give a really nice, deep aroma. It was very nice. And I will say, the coconut bread. Tell me about the coconut bread. Tell our listeners about that. It's not really just I think it's more of it is a sweet bread, but you say it's not. Or a breakfast. Well, it's more of a breakfast bread.
I guess so coconut bread, it's often called sweet bread in Trinidad and throughout the rest of the Caribbean. I guess the best way to describe it for readers would be as a quick bread. It's in that same canon as things like pumpkin bread and zucchini bread,
mm-hmm.
Or banana bread, right? It's that, flour and baking powder and then this fruit additive, and egg and butter and milk, right? So it's that quick bread category. So that's actually the consistency generally of it. That should be what it is. And so in Trinidad, historically, not so much anymore now, everything, Trinidad is very much like the United States. There are big supermarkets and all of these things that once were made only in the home or in very, very small bakeries are available in supermarkets. But even when I was a child and we would go visit, it was still very common for people to do all of their baking for the week on a Sunday after church. And so you would do all of your baking of savory breads and sweet breads, like coconut bread, for breakfast and for tea, actually, because being a British colony, they continued to have that tradition of tea, and children, you know, to this day, they come home from school, and we're in America, we say, do you want your snack? Trinidadian parents will say, you're ready for your tea. Mm. And, you know, and coconut bread is one of those things. So my father, when I was growing up, did not bake every Sunday, certainly. But a few times a year, he would bake, and he would make all of these goodies, the breads and the butter cake and sweet bread. And he did not include a key ingredient that in Trinidad they do include, and in fact, I don't particularly care for in this context, and maybe because I'm used to my father's version, which is the candied mixed fruit that, that you find in fruit cakes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's usually when they make this recipe, it's just like the recipe you see, but with that addition. I don't particularly care for that, and he didn't do that. So, but when he, and it was always a weekend when he did this, and we knew it was coming because these coconuts would show up from the West Indian market. And, you know, we knew that those coconuts would be grated to go into the, this coconut bread, which it was just some of my best memories of childhood were those baking days and this coconut bread.
Well, I can attest to the fact that it is delicious. It's great.
Thank you.
The other item, well, a couple of things. Kasareep syrup. I think we know that's, that, I think that's very interesting to talk about because it's used in savory stews. And can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so kasareep is actually made by boiling down cassava or yuca. And you boil it down until it becomes this really dark, almost bitter, but sweet as well, syrup. And now you can buy it very readily bottled in a Caribbean market.
Mm-hmm.
Although I do have a recipe to make it in Sweet Hands because it has other flavorings, right? It has cinnamon, it has cloves, and it has brown sugar. It is very much based in the West African tradition of browning meat, which is what, and this is pretty much how anything that isn't curried in Trinidad is often browned, which means you brown sugar into a caramel and then you add your meat. Kasareep is a deeper version of this idea, and it really gives a very rich, very aromatic, very multi-layered flavor profile. I use it outside of West Indian cooking for those dishes that I think really could be deepened in flavor and benefit from it. One of which, for example, would be cassoulet. I have added kasareep to cassoulet.
Mm.
And I've braised oxtails, which in kasareep, which is can be, you know, is another way to do that and kind of really deepens that flavor. So I encourage people to try it and to think about trying it very much in the way that they might use something like a thick soy sauce.
Right. Right. That's what it reminded me of in reading the recipe and looking at that. Although I did not try that, it's interesting that things that I think I guess you probably take for granted that are part of the country's cuisine and cooking, and I'm looking at different countries on every page, you know, from the piri piri sauce to a curry powder to Chinese five spice powder and a garam masala, It really is a coming together of so many influences and so many wonderful cuisines, and coconut plays such an important role in many of those dishes. And I will say I was surprised at, you said that, of course, heat, the pepper, the hot pepper, is one of the main features of the Trinidadian cuisine. And yet the Trinidad curry powder, you say, has no pepper.
Yes, it doesn't, and because the pepper is added separately.
Oh, okay. As needed.
And it's generally, you know, I believe that because, you know, everybody has their own taste and their level of heat that they can tolerate, and so they add it after. It's not uncommon in Trinidad to have people. I remember just eating very hot chili peppers, biting into them as a condiment while they eat. My father used to do this. It was fascinating to me to watch him eat when I was a child because he'd have his big plate of food, and for every fork full of food, he had these hot chili peppers, and he would just crunch off a bite and fill, and then you have a fork full of food, and he would eat three or four of these over the course of eating. yeah, so I think
love
that the absence of heat in the curry powder speaks to that desire to add the particular type of heat and a particular level of heat on your own after.
Right, right. Well, I have one last question for you. And that is, you've spent so much time there, and of course you're an accomplished chef and cook and writer of so many foods, but is there one flavor, one taste, or a particular dish that you crave when you're not there?
Mm-hmm. Yes, there is. There's two things, actually. The first is a fruit that's called, we call it pomerac. But it's actually south. It's from the South Pacific. It was one of the fruits brought by Captain Bligh to the Caribbean from the South Pacific, along with breadfruit and pineapple. And it's also called the Malay apple or the Otaheite apple. People, some of your listeners might have had it in Hawaii. And it kind of looks like a red pear, a small red pear, with it just a more scarlet-colored skin. And it's very white inside and very, it's got a sweet, tart, flavor and a consistency that's it's almost like a crisp pear. And it's so delicious, and it's too perishable to come to the United States. So I crave that very much. Mm. And the other thing is curried pomsite, which is pomsite or pomsiter, is a dendritic citrus fruit, a fruit that has like a pit in the middle that has almost arms coming and radiating out of it.
Mm.
It's very prickly. But they curry it, and it's got this just amazing, sweet, tart, and then the curry flavor, and it's the most delicious thing, and I really crave that because that's a little bit, you can get it here, the pomsite, but it's a little difficult to get.
Yeah.
I don't crave coconut anymore because we're so lucky.
You can have it anytime.
Get it here, right?
Right.
But I used to. When I was a child, I would just, you know, always be on the hunt for that coconut ice cream, that coconut cookie, that coconut lifesaver, the Mounds bar, those rare things in American culture that had coconut. And I don't have that problem anymore. So that's pretty great.
All right. Well, and anyone who's looking for new ways to use a coconut can certainly find it in your most recent book, Cooking with Coconut. Fascinating and beautiful photographs as well. And of course, Sweet Hands, your previous book on the island cooking of Trinidad and Tobago, will give people an insight into so many of these wonderful dishes and the influences that play in it. Ramin, thank you so much for joining me today. It has been a pleasure and an education, and I'm thrilled to have had you speak with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was a delight, and I appreciate it. Thanks again.
Thank you. Ramin Ganeshram, and I'm happy that you were listening and hope you'll tune in again. This is Linda Palacio for A Taste of the Past, and we are a show on the Heritage Radio Network. Check us out, heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.